Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast. It's a special. Woo-hoo! Today's guest is Harriet Harmer. Now, regular listeners will know a little while ago I said, I really want to get an MP on the podcast and talk to them all about being a politician. Harriet Harmer released a book called A Woman's Work, so I thought that's a good opportunity to get an MP on. Started reading her book, and wow, I really did enjoy it. It's such a great insight into the women's movement and her political career. It's just how tenacious she's been throughout the whole of her political career, and the abuse she got as a from the media and an MP, and she just kept going and going and going. And I thoroughly enjoyed the read. Kept quoting it at everybody, didn't I, Mark?
Yes, you've been looking forward to this one, and you had a lot of questions.
Yeah, it was frustrating because I there's so many things I wanted to ask her, and I realised
it was nearly as long as the book. Your notes.
I realised I was running out of time as well because she has to go off to go to Prime Minister Question Time. So you know, I there was a definite time she had to leave. And I was running out of time. I thought, oh, I could go into hours and hours on this because I just, you know, wanted to talk about anything. But what was interesting about it also was the fact that she, you know, as a politician, every time you go into an interview, you have to be switched on. For the first time ever as an interviewer, I felt that I had to be switched on as well because there's a few questions I must admit are poor because they're quite long-winded.
What would you give yourself out of 7?
Seven for some of those questions were poor. What happened was I was thinking as I was asking the question, am I coming across here as a Tory, or am I coming across here as socialist, or am I coming across here as racist or sexist, or where am I coming across? And I'm suddenly thinking people are going to pick my questions apart. I became a little bit paranoid. Fascinating, the world of politics. Everyone will have an opinion. By the way, I don't have any allegiance to any party, and I don't lean one way or the other. I think I'm straight down the middle.
It was a tough ask in a sense on this for you on this podcast, because we're not a political podcast. We're not. She so happens to be a Labour politician, but it was because of the book that you interviewed her. So it was kind of a tough thing for you to do. But I think you did all right. I think you did pretty well.
There's some parts where she's very critical of the Conservatives, but you know
she's always going to be if she's a Labour politician.
That's the way it works.
We'll have a Conservative on at some point, and they'll be
what we're going to do the balance thing like the BBC.
No, but I'm saying at some point down the road, won't we?
Yeah, hopefully. We'll get loads of different politicians on. I quite like talking to them. I learned a lot, and that's the important thing. Anyway, her book's called A Woman's Work. It's all about the women's movement and equality. And this is Harriet Harmer.
There's a good question to look forward to at the end.
Oh, yes.
That doesn't get answered.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm like Paxman.
Pac-Man.
Andrew Marr, I was there.
Johnny Marr.
No. There is a question she won't answer. Anyway.
You're like Robert Peston from The Ordinary Boys.
I'm one of them. Here's Harriet Harmer.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to my kitchen, Harriet. Thank you for coming today. I've got you a present. I get all my guests a present. So this is a lovely bottle of red wine.
Thank you.
Do you drink red wine?
I do, and white wine, and rosé, and spirits.
Do you ever... you drink a lot. Do you ever drink with the Oppo in the Commons?
No.
No.
I kind of don't drink at work. I kind of feel I need all my faculties to be whizzing away. And so kind of work is very different from relaxation for me. Work is not relaxing at all.
One of the things that you talk about in your book, we'll get into your book in a minute, Woman's Work, A Woman's Work, is the alcohol culture in the Commons years ago, the amount of alcohol that was being consumed by the MPs. was quite immense, wasn't it?
I think it was a very bad thing for the MPs, and it was a very bad thing for politics, because what would happen is the House of Commons would start at 2:30 in the afternoon and go through always until 10 o'clock at night, often till 11:30, and it was not unusual for it to go through to 1 o'clock. So sometimes the men would have had a job during the morning that they would do out in the city or in the law courts, come in, have a spot of lunch, often with alcohol, you know, hang around a bit in the chamber, then have dinner with plenty of wine, and then hang around in the chamber again. And the atmosphere did get, I mean, you know, those who weren't actually entirely roaring drunk were not sober and were not actually at their best.
Yeah.
And it was just a very... very bad atmosphere. And because there was no broadcasting of the House of Commons, there was no radio reporting of the House of Commons, there was no television reporting. The only journalists who were allowed in were an elite group of journalists in the press lobby. It was a bit like a secret that this was going on. And one day, Clare Short, who was an MP, when Alan Clark, who wrote his very famous diaries, he was a minister, he came in absolutely plastered after lunch to do a statement in the House of Commons, a ministerial statement. And he was plastered. And Clare said, I think that he does a disrespect for this House of Commons to come to the dispatch box as a minister and make a statement in that state. And she was rebuked by the Speaker because it's unparliamentary to call another Member of Parliament drunk, even if they are, and even if you don't mention the word drunk. So I can't describe how much drink was part of the culture. The bars would be open all night, way beyond licensing hours, just until the House stopped sitting, so till 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning. And the booze was very cheap because it was completely subsidised. And it was like 97% men. So it was a very male drinking culture and not good at all. Now, it has changed enormously, not completely. And I used to see some members of House of Commons coming in, and they'd come in as sort of new and hopeful and enthusiastic, and they'd be ruined by drink.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said it's changed. Now, I've read your book. I like it a lot. It's such a, as you came in, it's changed my views on a lot of things. And also changed my view on you as well, which is good. Do you enjoy being interviewed, by the way? Because politicians and interviews, it's just like a big game now, isn't it? Is it?
Well, I'm not sure it's a game. I think it's a kind of quest, because I think that I'm in politics because I was sort of part of a movement that looked around at how things were and thought, no, this is not fair, this is not right.
I know, we'll get on to that, but what I'm trying to say is every time you do an interview at the moment, the interviewer is trying to catch you out. That's their job now, it seems, as a viewer. It's painful sometimes for us to watch. And rather than listen to what you have to say, the political journalist has to try and beat the politician. So every single time you go into a discussion, you know you're in a war.
Yeah. You say it's painful to watch. It's painful to be doing it as well. And it is a bit like an obstacle course. But the reason is you're trying to get to the end, which is to say something about what you believe in or to propose something you want to change. It's kind of par for the course, really. I mean, perhaps it shouldn't be like that. But actually, if you go to other countries where there's great respect and reverence for the members of parliament and for ministers are treated like gods, you think, come on, you know, ask a bit of a spiky question, for goodness sake.
Yeah, you're right. You have to be held accountable. But every single time you go into an interview, you know that I might be sitting here with a question that could get, I mean, I'm not. I don't know, you never know, I might be. But I could be sitting here with a question that will get you all the headlines away from talking about a woman's work. And you know every time you go into an interview, you've got that guy trying to, or that girl trying to do that.
And also, the other thing is that you can do a little tiny local radio station.
Yeah.
And you can have a kind of adventurous interviewer who will ask the spiky question. And at that point, it will not just be on that local radio station. It will be all around the country and even on the main news. So there's jeopardy. There's always jeopardy.
And you enjoy that or not?
It's just an occupational hazard. And I kind of feel quite mixed feelings about it, because on the one hand, I don't like to be the subject of it. And it's like annoying because I just want to say what I think and not have anybody disagree with me. Who doesn't? But on the other hand, I don't like acquiescent media cultures that treat politicians like... you know, like saints.
All right, so let's get into the book then. A Woman's Work, what's it about?
Well, really, it's about the massive changes that have been in women's lives, both in the life in the family, in life in the world of work, in the life in politics. It's been really a social revolution over the last 30 or 40 years. And it is quite... I thought it was really... It's quite hard to explain to younger women what it was like growing up as a girl in the 1950s, because the ambition, the most important ambition for a young girl, was to get a husband. Mm-hmm. And once you'd achieved that heady ambition, was to service and support that husband and be his housewife. And that's the way it was. And the women's movement swept in, and it was with my generation, and I was part of it, and it said... No, we're not going to take our husband's name, promise to obey him, make his dinner, be subordinate to him. We're going to be equal partners. And this was a revolutionary thought. So really it was I had to describe what it was like in those days. And like, for example, my mother, very unusually, qualified as a barrister. But once she'd achieved the lofty ambition of marrying my father... She gave up being a barrister in order to cook his dinner and cook his breakfast and look after his home. And it's quite poignant now when I look back on it and think that her wig and her gown was in our dressing up box. Mm. And that was...
Yeah, but she told you to never rely on men, but also try and find yourself a professional, didn't she, as a husband? So she'd moved on a bit.
Well, but... she and my dad, there was four of us girls, they were... quite ambivalent, because on the one hand they wanted us to get a husband, because you know, if you didn't get a husband, you were like, and there was a whole range of language for you. You were a spinster, you were on the shelf, you were a wallflower. I mean, you were really a very pitiful creature. So they wanted us to get a husband, but they also wanted us to get an education, because they wanted us to be financially independent, not to have to depend on benefits or not have to depend on a man. But you mustn't get too educated, because no man would want a woman who was too clever by half, not somebody who might look cleverer than him. So it was like, oh God, you know, we've got to be clever, but not too clever. We've got to be financially independent, but never earn more than your husband, because that would totally unman him. So it was quite a conflicted time. And the women's movement said, why don't we just all do what we want to do, what we're best at? Why don't we share? Let's not have him as head of the household with his word going. Let's not have Parliament where 97% are men and only 3% women, because men made all the decisions and women abided by them. So it was like quite a revolutionary philosophy, and that we were decided, well, we're just going to have to change everything.
Yeah, my mum ended up earning more money than my dad, and she was a working mum, and also she did everything with the kids as well. My dad just went to work, my mum did both. So I'm very much aware of what was going on. But back in the, it's interesting, I think anyone who's going on the marches or who's interested in this, which seems to be everyone at the moment, should have a read of your book, because it reminds you of just how totally backward it was years ago. The idea that when you were trying to get a job as a solicitor, and people would say, we've already got one, as we've already got a woman. I mean, that was sort of commonplace. When I'm reading the book, I just sort of started remembering how I felt about women coming through, especially things like women getting into the army. I was horrified. Why would women go into the army? So people like you have managed to change my attitude. I've come a lot, we all have, I think, the whole of Britain has come a long way since when you started your campaigns. But are we on the final push, do you think?
I think we are. And I think it's very interesting because of what you say, because I think the attitudes of men have changed as well. The women's movement was all about women's attitudes changing and our aspirations changing. Mm. I mean, it used to be commonplace for the woman to take the man's name. But in my mum's day, they used to take the first name as well as the second name. So she used to get letters saying to Mrs. John Harmon. I mean, literally. And so the women's movement was all about women asserting themselves. But actually, there was an argument that about men being equal partners and a change in men's role. And one of the things that is so really illuminating for me now is we've got a generation of sons of the women's movement, which are men of your generation, who have been brought up with a different sense of actually what the relationship should be like between men and women and what roles there are in society between men and women. And to see that happening in the House of Commons is revelatory for me. I mean, it used to be that, you know, a man in the House of Commons was by definition very important, much too important to be doing anything at home. So therefore, his supportive and admiring wife would completely look after the children. He would delegate all his family responsibilities to her, and he would be being important in Parliament. And now we've got a generation of younger men who actually see their wives as equals and who also regard their role in their own family as important. And honestly, I'm nearly in a dead faint half the time because I never thought I'd live to see the day.
Well, yeah, you say that. I've been in family court twice. Actually, this was one of the really interesting things when I read your book, because I've been in the family court twice. I've been in there recently as well. And even though we are looking for equality in the family, sadly, the judges are still not aware that the laws are in place for equality in the family. And I think it's one of those things that's a real problem for the country if you want to do pure equality. Because if you've got equality in the workplace and you haven't got equality in the family, as in men and women don't feel they're equal in the family, then you can't have it both ways, can you?
But I think it's partly a question of the institutions lagging behind the changes that have actually happening. Because time was when a man would never be seen with his hands on the handle of a pram.
Yeah.
Because it would be like unmanly. And that was the mindset in the courts, as well as in Parliament, as well as in the world of work. And it's that really profound change that everybody's got to catch up with, including in the courts, and therefore not to make assumptions. The woman's going to be looking after the children, the man isn't. But to say what is happening in this family.
Yeah, this is the thing I think is important, is employers have to look at men and women equally when it comes to children. So in Scandinavia, would you agree we're behind Scandinavia? Not in laws, but maybe in attitude. When a man and woman have a baby, they both think we're going to go back to work. Whereas in this country, often the man goes, I'm going back to work and I can't afford not to do that. So I'm going to work and you're going to look after the child. And our laws, even though they're kind of going towards equality, the judges and people, I mean, basically, as soon as you get involved in family law, everyone goes, look, you're a man, everyone's equal, but you're not, you're just, some are more equal than others, basically, when it comes to that. And that is a slight problem, don't you think? Because if you've got men who want to go back to work and women who want to go back to work, and both of them want to look after the children, that's the perfect solution.
Well, there is an institutional lag with the institutions not catching up with the changes that are actually taking place in family life. But I think in many families where a man wants to spend more time with his children, wants to take paternity leave, wants to take parental leave, they can't afford to, because usually he will be earning more than her. And at a time when the demands on the household budget increase because of the expense of having a child, if her income is less than his, it makes sense for the family for her to drop back on her work and for him to probably even be working more. And that's as a result of unequal pay in the world of work. And then that reinforces itself.
Yeah.
Whereas in Scandinavia, and honestly, wouldn't we all move to Scandinavia if it didn't get so dark so early? I mean, honestly, I'd be up there like a shot.
Yeah.
Because they really have legislated for, and they have a culture which treats as a norm the idea that men and women who are working are parents as well. And of course, it's a no-brainer. However, I have one thing to say about that, is that they have a long period of parental leave where men can take it. And this is about Norway, but they can take it. They can choose when to take it. And it's like a couple of months before the child is five. And they did a survey and they discovered that there was a coinciding between these men taking leave, and guess what?
What?
the elk hunting season. And in another country they did it and discovered it was with the World Cup.
Mm.
So, I mean, I don't want to be too cynical, actually, because I love Scandinavia and, you know.
Well, I spent a lot of time, I did documentary on, I started a documentary on fathers' rights. In it, I met a lot of really powerful women who were really keen on men getting more rights because it would help women, basically, the women's movement. But I soon realised it was about children's rights when I started the documentary. But I really thought that the most important thing is not legislation. I think we're kind of there. I think what we need is social attitude. And what you're showing with your book is how far we've come. We've still got that final push. And I think it comes with both things, how women are viewed in the workplace. And I think how family is viewed as well. At the moment, work is so much more. And you've just said it there. We need the money. Work is, in this country, work is king. And the family comes secondary to the work. And I think we need to sort of readdress the balance. And in Scandinavia, they'll always, employers, as far as I'm aware, and the ones that I know, they're always like, if you want to do a school run, go and do the school run. It's important you do your family. So there is lots of flexibility amongst employers.
But I think in a way that has been not just a cultural change that it's evolved. It's been led by a government paying high levels of paternity pay so men can afford to take it, giving a long period of time for paternity leave. So I think that there is a role for government in backing that change, which is not about forcing men to take time off work, but really enabling them to by making it affordable. So I think we're a long way away still from where we want to be. Definitely we're still a long way from where we want to be. We need the culture change, but we need the law change as well and the finances to back it. Because it's all very well saying to fathers, you can take 2 weeks off work, but a lot of families, they can't afford to lose 2 weeks income. I mean they just can't, especially with all the expenses you have to buy when you've got a child. And then of course when women are working part-time, they are treated like the lowest of the low at work. You know, their income absolutely plunges, and even per hour they just earn less. So there's a lot of changes to be made, but I now feel that actually there is a real chance with the growth of feminism, but also men joining in the argument. And actually, the thing about men fighting for their rights is like a twofold thing. Because on the one hand, there's men fighting for their rights against women, if you like, in relation to children, when there's a dispute. But there's another issue, which is men fighting for the rights of men in families to have higher paternity leave, longer paternity leave and higher paternity pay. Because we used to complain in the women's movement. We used to say we fought for maternity leave, we fought for maternity pay. Now, for God's sake, we're fighting for paternity leave as well. Why don't the men do it? Why do we have to fight for their rights? We're exhausted.
Yeah, see, this is the point I'm making. And I think you might misconstrue me that I'm saying I'm looking for father's rights. It was originally because I was like, why don't I have equality with my children? When it was really that weird thing that it was so interesting reading your book, where you woke up one day and had the realization, why aren't I equal? And it was kind of the same with me.
But it took us like three decades to fight for it. But
100%. But I've got three daughters. And I'm looking at them going, hey, they're going to go off and they're very bright and they're going to go off and have an education and then they're going to have a family. And then Britain looks at them and British law goes, you've had a baby. So now what you have to do is you have to look after that child. Meanwhile, your husband can do what the hell he wants. Mm. If he wants to turn up and look after the children, he can. He's got the ace card as long as he's got a job. And going through your book, I don't know what your family setup exactly was, but basically you were fighting a million causes. I mean, you were relentless, but not only that, you were also having to bring up your children at the same time, and you had to go through all the guilt of actually holding down a job whilst bringing up your children. I'm sure your husband didn't have to do that.
Yeah, well, I think that to be a parent is often to just be guilty anyway, isn't it, really? It just comes with the territory. And I think if you've been brought up by a mother whose focus was the home, it is a bit of a frightening thought that you're doing an experiment with your children by working so committedly outside the home. And I had plenty of people that wrote to me when I first became an MP, and half of them would write saying, get in there, get on there, change the world, fantastic to see you in there. And the other half would say, what are you doing? Mm. You are going to ruin your children. They are going to truant from school. And that, you know, feeling of anxiety that are you doing the right thing is very difficult. But I wondered whether or not, I always wonder how these attitudes are changing. And when I talk to young people, students at schools in my constituency in Camberwell and Peckham, I always ask the girls, when are you going to go to, and they're all wanting to go to university and full of brightness and ambition. And I say, when you have a child, will you expect to step back a bit in your career? Or would you expect to be on an equal footing with your partner and for your both to be sharing the care of the child? And they say, sharing. And then I ask the boys, do you expect that your career will take into account having a child, or will you be just zooming forward with your ambition, you know, doing ever, ever better? And they go, oh, zooming forward. So there's a disconnect even now between attitudes of young men and young women, and it's going to cause a conflict.
Which is the point I'm making on it totally. And so as soon as you end up in a family court, as soon as you speak to a judge, as soon as you speak to a lawyer, as soon as you speak to anyone, they go, yeah, the mum's not quite as equal now. She has to look after the child. That's your responsibility. Man, go and help, do what they want. And we need, I think, I don't know, every time I look at the march, I think, hold on, they need to change that dramatically. So my daughters grow up and they may meet a man who has the attitude you're talking about, who says, I want to share with the family responsibilities.
There's more
as well.
Chance of that now. I mean, with my husband, what was very unusual about him was that he was part of progressive men who supported the women's movement. They felt the women's movement was for us. And, you know, there was a saying, women have to be the engine of their own liberation. Yeah. So it was for us and for they were not to nose into it. But actually, he supported me going out to work. But it was never expected that supporting the wife to go out to work would be like helping her with the children. I mean, it was enough to support her going out to work. My father wouldn't have supported the idea of my mother going out to work. For the next generation, i.e. my generation, the men supported us to go out to work, but not to the extent of actually helping out at home. They supported ideologically, but they didn't actually show up in the kitchen. Now we're getting a generation where they're not only supporting women to go out to work and seeing them more as equal, but they're actually sharing the childcare responsibility a bit, not quite as much. And of course, there's care of older relatives now, which is another really big thing. And still women are doing the lion's share of that. Actually.
Yeah, do we need a shift towards us in this country caring more about our families than our work in a nice way? But we're becoming, you know, we've all got smartphones and things.
But we have to do both, because the point is that, you know, everybody is both earning a living and making the economy work and bringing up the next generation. And, you know, you'll wake up after an operation in a hospital bed and the woman at your bedside will be somebody's mother. And actually, her child might well be looking after you and giving you extra care and support when you're elderly. So, you know, we do need functional young people being brought up as the next generation. Yeah. And we need the economy to work as well. And it's been no good having a view that, which base is based on the idea that the economy is what men do, and therefore you didn't have to think about the family because that's what women did. Yeah. They were at home sorting all of that.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's. I mentioned you did. You're relentless. You've non-stop battled, haven't you, for rights for all sorts of people, but especially women. Tell us some of the highlights of what you've done. There's so many in your book. I can't go through them, but you keep going and going. What are some of the highlights you've had? You've done.
Well, I think arriving after the election in 1997, where we'd had a massive push for there to be more Labour women MPs, because really, you know, if you've got a House of Commons which is 97% men and only 3% women, and I was one of only 10 Labour women MPs, is that it felt like, you know, your voice was completely marginalised and the things that preoccupied women were just never got a hearing. And after the 97 election, because we'd actually done an organisational change to force a selection of Labour women into seats that we were going to win, we turned up in the House of Commons on that day after we won the election in 97 with 100 Labour women. Mm. And that was like, oh my word, everything has changed. Instead of us being marginal, we're a critical mass. And I knew that women could see on telly not only the serried ranks of men in grey suits, but could see women there. And people would say at the checkout counters in supermarkets, we've seen you all in the House of Commons. And it was like revelatory.
And then the headlines said Blair's Babes. And when you said that in the book, I remember it. And I remember thinking, you're so right. All that good work. And then they go and do that. I mean, it was to obviously massage Tony Blair's ego.
But the thing about Blair's Babes, you know, what happened was we had all these women arriving. But of course, Tony Blair had led the party to a massive landslide. So what they did is they characterised us women MPs as a sort of backing group with Tony Blair, the rock star, and us, the backing group. And actually, these women, these 100 women, were women from all around the country, from Scotland, Wales, from every region, of all ages, of all walks in life. And they had fought their way in. And to then be described as Blair's Babes. But what it was is the media, the very male-dominated, old-fashioned media, belittling us. And actually, it was disrespecting our voters as well, because each of us were elected and each of our voice in Parliament was as important as anybody else's voice in Parliament, because we were all elected MPs. And it was immediately like trivialising us and like, don't take any notice of them, they're just Blair's Babes. And we were kind of annoyed about it at the time, obviously. But when I look back at it, it was like, don't give them a chance, even from the moment they start. We'd not only battled to get in, but once we were in, we had to be battling to be taken seriously. God, I feel exhausted just describing it.
Yeah.
And it's like, can I lie down somewhere?
And the media was there. I mean, that's when I said my perception of you changed. That's interesting, because through reading your book, I listened to your side of everything. At the time, and you admit this in your book, when I was growing up, the Labour Party were in disarray. They were hopeless. I mean, it really was quite a sad party, I think, at the time. And then New Labour came along, and it was very exciting. But the only paper which was really, I suppose, representing you guys was The Mirror. And I was probably reading more right-wing media at the time. So every time you were doing something about women's rights, they would hammer you in the media. And I realised how susceptible I was to all that. You know, you were hurting housewives, basically, was the way they were always portraying you. And that's how I thought of you. And that's how I thought of a lot about the issues which were going on. It's a lesson for me to learn that every time I hear something, I've got to listen to both sides of it, because the media plays such an important part in this, don't they?
But I think in a way, I do wonder whether or not that sort of hegemony of the media, where it can dictate and shape attitudes so profoundly, I wonder whether social media is changing that, and whether or not the people, it's less controlled.
I don't know, confirmation bias. I mean,
do you think so?
Yeah, people just looking. If you're
at least you've got a little space to have your bias confirmed. I mean, yeah. In those days, I didn't even have one of those.
If you're right wing at the moment, you just go on and you get all right wing propaganda. Yeah. If you're left wing, you get left wing propaganda.
But at least we've got a bit of space to reinforce and support ourselves. We didn't have any mainstream media that was supporting the women's movement. I suppose The Guardian
did.
But
the flat earth movement is growing. I mean, it's because you can find enough evidence now to support it. I feel sorry for the astronauts who are saying, what?
But I think
I've seen it.
But I think although the mainstream media was painting me and any other women as like strident, thick, icy, unnatural, and really being very undermining, the women's movement was a very strong movement, and there was women in all walks of life who were trying to travel that same road, and there was a support there. So every time I went out and about, there would be women coming up to me saying, keep on doing what you're doing, because that would be somebody who was being a social worker, or that's somebody who was working, you know, in a business, and they were having their own battles.
Yeah, but you point out in your book that it was quite militant as well, wasn't it? There was sort of women's movement in, but I'm talking about right back in the beginning, in the 70s, there was someone who wanted equality and someone who wanted domination. It was their turn. You point out in your book that it wasn't all happy, was it, in the camp of women's movement?
Well, there was different strands. There were the strands of the women's movement which was discussing sexuality, which would be like consciousness-raising groups, and that would all sit round in rooms, and, you know, lesbianism would be discussed, which was like a really radical and surprising thought. You know, the pill had just come in, so the question of you know, women having more sexual freedom. There was a lot of left-wing men that placed a lot of store on that and hoped that then these women would all be liberated to have plenty of sex with them. So they took a bit of an interest in that. So that was the sort of consciousness-raising group. Then there was the domestic violence movement. Because in those days, it was expected that a man would keep his wife in order. He was the head of the household. Sometimes she'd need a slap in order to be kept in order, and that was his responsibility. And if he overdid it and blacked her eyes and broke her ribs, well, she probably brought it on herself. And that was the attitude. And the domestic violence part of the women's movement said, no, that is a criminal act. And that was like, oh my goodness me. And when that was raised, people said it was undermining the family structure to campaign against domestic violence. So Erin Pizzey set up the first, not very far from here, the first women's refuge, women's aid. And then there was the domestic violence movement, and they tended to be very suspicious of men because their experience of men was about brutality. So they didn't want to have anything to do with men. They didn't want men involved in the family. They didn't want, you know, men looking after their children because they were, like, dangerous. Mm-hmm. And that was the, you know, a bit of a caricaturing of the domestic violence movement. Then there was the part I was involved in, which was about women's rights, putting the law into a situation where it gave women rights at work, gave women equal pay, protected women against sex discrimination. And that's what I was involved in. So there was different strands of it.
I think all the things you talk about in your book, you seem really balanced. Everything seems to be fair in your mind. Yet every single step of the way you get criticism, did it take its toll?
It did. And the combination of the relentless criticism, and you worry about that, not in relation just to yourself, but your family. You know, you think of your parents reading about in the papers, everybody saying you're terrible. So a combination of the relentless criticism, but also the maternal guilt and the anxiety about trying to keep the show on the road, bringing up young children as well as working, made me want to give up a lot, especially when the kids were younger. And many a time my head would be down on the kitchen table and I'd be saying, that's it, I can't go on. But I had to, because once you've picked up the flag to say women can be in the House of Commons, they can be mothers as well as going out to work. If I'd have thrown in the towel, then everybody would have turned around and said, oh, this is what we told you. Mm. Women can't hack it. And therefore, I couldn't, because all those other women who were also trying to do the impossible.
Did you ever doubt yourself, though, in the stuff that you believed in?
No, I didn't doubt what I believed in.
Because I do. This is what someone taught you. I believe in pure equality. My dad actually said to me when I was doing the documentary, sharing Mum and Dad, he said to me, be careful. And I went, my God, a lot of people won't like you, and you've got a good career and stuff. And it's like, what? And I just thought, well, I'm just talking about mums and dads. It's just you and stuff. But because he's a lot older and stuff like that. And
well,
it's like,
very visceral, because it's very deep.
Yeah.
So if you stir those waters, it brings up.
He was very proud when it came out, and the reaction was fantastic, you know, from both sides, you know, men and women, everything, mums and dads, everyone, everyone liked it. But I worry, I think pure equality is the way to go. And then I sometimes question it, because I hear a lot of women who say they don't want that. They like gender roles.
But that's about choice. But in a way, it's about choice. I mean, my mother had no choice but to give up and look after her.
I like
so
that.
So really, yeah. And some men would really want to choose to be working part-time and not have their employer look at them as if they just didn't care about their work and not committed and not ambitious anymore, because after all, they've asked to work part-time. And I think it's really about choice. And I think if people have that choice, then they are better at work and better at home. So it's not about dictating equality. It's about equal opportunity to choose your role without it all being defined.
So I met a girl from Norway over here not so long ago, a woman from Norway, and she'd moved over here because she was a single mum and she didn't want to work, and she said people in Norway frown upon her for it because they expect women to, she's highly educated.
Well, how old are her children?
Oh, school age. So they were going to school, and that's what she thought. She thought that she should go back to school.
Yeah, but you see, I think that if kids are at school, you know, there's some hours in the day, not if they're in nursery and they're just only 2.5 hours or something. But I think that once your kids are working in school, there are some hours in the day. And if it is possible, then I think you should work, because otherwise other people are going to have to work to support you. So not everybody can find school hours work.
But that's when you know you're going to have women shouting at this now, going, I don't want to, I'm a mother, and that's what I want to do, and that's an important role.
Well, but when the kids are at school, you know, what are you doing? Now, I know that it's always half term. I know it's always, you know, inset days. I know this kid's always off with, you know, ill for one reason or another. So it's easier said than done to work term times. But a lot of women in my constituency, they do work just a few hours during the week. They work when the kids are at school. Yeah. And certainly I would never want to be just at home when the kids were at school, because I would think, I want to be showing my kids the example that you can be a breadwinner and you don't just wait for benefits to come. You actually work to provide for yourself and your children.
Mm, and that's where I can see people saying, well, you're saying I'm lazy because I'm not doing that, and but I'm looking after the home.
Well, I wouldn't say it's lazy, but I think that, I mean, in the olden days, well, when I was back in government, there was a huge row about the New Deal for lone parents, where in the olden days, you could get income support up until your youngest child was 16. Mm-hmm. And that meant you would have full-time pay on benefits without looking for a job. And if you'd had three or four children, well, then, you know, you'd probably be 25 years or something until you started to look for your first job, by which time it would be absolutely impossible. So we brought in the New Deal for lone parents, which said, come into the job centre, have an interview, see whether there's a training course you want to do when the kids are at school, start thinking about going back to work. All hell broke loose. And it was like, well, how really do you actually need to be a stay-at-home mother completely at home until the youngest child is 16? So, you know, but these are very controversial waters. So I'm afraid I'm not, you know, I do think work is important because I think it brings a kind of dignity and self-respect to be earning your own money instead of being given it by somebody else, whether it's given it by a man or given it by benefits. Okay. But that's my parents speaking to me again.
Talking about controversial, you've been fighting for equality for decades, and then suddenly a few years ago it turns out the BBC aren't, which is publicly owned, aren't equal with their pay. That must have been really shocking for you.
Well, it wasn't shocking or surprising to me in the least. I mean, it was like very annoying. But actually, one of the reasons why I put in the Equality Act 2010, that there should be like transparency and that organisations should be required to show what they pay their men and show what they pay their women, was so that we should have it all out on the table, not for naming and shaming, mm-hmm. but so that we can say, right, what is the pay gap here? And therefore, what can we do to narrow it? Because if you've got a pay gap, which is probably about 30%, per hour, women are probably paid about 30% less than men. You've either got to believe that they are 30% less intelligent, less committed to their work, less useful than men, which we don't, or else you've got to recognise it's pay discrimination. So I think that it was a real moment, you know, when Carrie Gracie, the China editor, came to the House of Commons and spoke to the Select Committee about how she was paid about half what John Soper was paid for being the American editor. And he doesn't have to speak Mandarin and he doesn't risk being arrested. And yet she was paid less than him. And that was fine when it was all kept swept under the carpet. And now it's out in the open. And I think that it's going to lead to change.
Yeah. You spent most of your life in opposition, well, your early career in opposition. Then New Labour came along. And I like your book because you were very honest about the Labour Party. It was far too left at one stage. People weren't taking it seriously enough. The voters didn't like it particularly. New Labour came along. That word New Labour was that invented by Alastair Campbell?
I can't remember who invented it. But what it was basically saying was that this is the Labour Party with the same values and principles, but times have changed, and therefore we're different as a party because we are going to reflect things in the future as they are. And there'd always been a choice, which you could either have like a strong economy, and that was the Conservatives, or you could have a caring, you know, heartfelt party, and that was the Labour Party. But what New Labour said is actually a strong economy and social justice go hand in hand. That's how things, and it was like, Yes.
It was so exciting.
It
and,
was.
And the public loved it, didn't they? Because
yeah.
because didn't Tony Blair get in with the biggest majority ever of a prime minister? Was it something fact like that?
He did. Yeah. And there was such a sense of enthusiasm. People had got fed up with the feeling that the country was so divided and Tony Blair was going to be a completely new sort of prime minister. And in my constituency on that day in 1997, people were flooding into the polling stations who'd never voted before. And they were saying, this is in my constituency in Camberwell and Peckham, how do we vote for Tony Blair? And it was like, yeah. It's me, actually. You know, he's not on the ballot paper here. It's me. Can you just to put across next to Harriet Harman? But there was, they wanted to vote for Tony Blair. There was such enthusiasm. They wanted him to lead the country.
And it must have been nice to suddenly be not in opposition for a while, to actually to have the chance to change stuff.
It was, because the thing is that I had been in the House of Commons since 1982, and here we were in 1997, and I had been voting every week, every night, up until, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning sometimes, never won a vote. Never. I mean, imagine all that voting, and you never win anything. All that speeching, or speechifying, all those making arguments, all producing evidence, and never being able to do or change anything. It is the most frustrating thing. And you see, I mean, I used to see such terrible things that we wanted to change. Like, in my local hospital, Guy's, I went on a visit to see the cardiology department. As an MP, you go round the institutions in your constituency. And the cardiologist showed me a list on the wall of all these names and addresses, and it was his operating list. And he ran his finger to about halfway down, and he said, all the people below here will be dead before I operate on them. Wow. And that was the waiting list. And I looked at these names and addresses. They were people in my constituency. And, like, you want to get into government so you can change that. So it's not academic or theoretical. It was like, terrible things are going on. We can get in and change them.
And did you?
Yes, we did. We trebled the amount. You know, people used to, I look at the pie charts I do of things that come, people come to see me about in my advice surgery, and there used to be such a big section for the health service. You know, somebody would come in, sit down, they say, you know, I need a hip operation, my hip's absolutely terrible, you know, I can't go upstairs because it's too painful, so I have to sleep on the sofa downstairs and I have to have a bucket because the loo's upstairs, and I just feel humiliated. And I've now got an appointment at King's College Hospital, and then they show me the letter, 2 years' time. You know, and that's what it was like. And we trebled the investment in the health service, and we set targets. You've got to get your treatment within 6 weeks. And it really changed things now. I mean, you know, people stopped coming in complaining about not being able to get an operation because they were in there. It's starting to go wrong again, I'm afraid.
Well, you make a point in the book about a lot of things that New Labour did, but sadly the legacy has to be the weapons of mass destruction and the bankers and the breakdown of the economy. Is that sad that that's what, if we look back at New Labour, we go, Tony Blair took us into an illegal war and Gordon Brown ruined our economy. I mean, you try and explain them both away in the book, but that's kind of the legacy, isn't it?
Well, I think, you know, at one level it is. But actually, we did save the health service. I mean, the Conservatives before 97 were saying, you know, the health service is finished. You know, it's an impossible setup. It can't meet the demand. It's a bottomless pit. We'll have to go off to a private healthcare system, insurance-based. We'll give tax relief for private healthcare. That's the way we should go. And we said, no, we really want to have the health service. So, and that was an enduring thing. I mean, actually, the global financial crisis, which we're still feeling the economic effects of. I mean, the clue is in the name, global. I mean, Gordon Brown was not running the American economy. He was not responsible for Lehman Brothers and all these derivatives and the what was going on in the States in their financial sector. We did have a very big financial services sector in this country, and obviously the regulation was insufficient. And we were, like, happily receiving all the tax revenue from the financial services and all the massive employment growth without actually regulating it strongly enough so that we were very exposed when the global financial crisis happened. But once it did happen, Gordon Brown leapt into action. in order to prevent what was a recession turning into an absolute depression and a global collapse. So I think in decades to come, people will look at Gordon Brown's role, and far from saying he caused the global financial crisis, that he saved the situation from being even worse than it could otherwise have been. But okay. I can hear everybody doing hollow laughs at that point. And I'm happy to talk about the Iraq war as well if you want, so people can do more hollow laughs about that if you want.
There's a few things I'd like to do. Oh, I'm conscious of time, and there's a couple of things I'd really like to talk about, because immigration is absolutely huge at the moment in the news. I'm going to go so far at my depth here, and I'm worried about it. But obviously, being MP for Peckham, it's been a big thing in your life, because there's been a lot of immigration in Peckham. Here's the tough conundrum for you. You mention in your book of the cultural differences there are. Some religions and some cultures don't treat women equally. So where is the... How do you juggle tolerance versus equality?
Well, I think it's quite straightforward, really, which is it's almost thinking about it as a human rights basis. So I remember when I was working on domestic violence, which I've always been, working on that as part of the women's movement. And some people would say to me, well, you must understand that for some, African traditional cultures, it's expected that a man should be able to beat his wife because that is his responsibility, and that you mustn't clash with that culture, you must respect it. But my vantage point was the rights of any woman in this country, whether she's an African woman or an English woman, she should have the same protection from violence. Okay, so you just look at it as an individual.
Yeah, but that's the sort of extreme cases. But just you want equality. You want a pure equality. You want men and women to be equal. Even in I'm not religious. I have no religion, so I don't understand it massively. But the Church of England doesn't even have women as equal. I mean, yeah. I think haven't they got a bishop in London now? But whether we're going to
they've got a carve out in the Equality Act, whereas religious organisations can decide that they don't allow women to minister. I mean, the Church of England hasn't been forced by law to do that. It's decided, but it can decide to continue to discriminate.
But that's quite progressive. Yeah. So how do you juggle this? The tolerance of religions and cultures versus equality for women. I mean, many of them don't look at women as equal.
Well, I think that it's, they don't. And I think that within those religions themselves, those women from within those religions have pushed for greater rights. And so there's a combination of, pushing through laws in parliament and changing things in the way we've discussed, but also recognising that there are women within those religions who are pushing for change.
But if we were a country who just went, well, equality trumps everything, then I'm looking at this wonderful life where equality is pure and everything, but wouldn't that help the situation? But I don't have a religion,
I think that these things, take longer than you would want them to be. And I know that there are women in all religions who are challenging the notion that it's their religion that dictates their inferior status, and are actually saying that that's a cultural and social construct, and therefore they're arguing that for their change. But I think in a way, what we've done is we've supported women in those religions to press for that change,
okay.
Whether they be Jewish, whether they be Muslim, whether they be Church of England or any other religion, rather than having the state dictating it.
Right.
Which does leave you with an anomalous situation because it allows them to rampantly carry on discriminating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not helping, is it?
Well, I just don't think, these things take much longer than you would want them to do.
All right. How do you MP for Peckham, how do you get a lot of cultural differences? We've got maybe some problems with it at the moment. That's maybe why Brexit happened. Or how do you create a harmonious society then?
Well, I think that the recognizing that everybody's got a contribution to make, and that this country has benefited from successive waves of immigration. Sometimes I think people have been prey to invented fears which have been put out on the internet. Sometimes there's real fears. I mean, I remember, you know, which are genuine. Like, I remember going around in the 2010 election, the BMW factory in Oxford, and a guy saying to me, you know, that guy who works, you know, two or three guys down on the production line, he's paid £5 an hour less than me. And I know that if ever there's redundancies or layoffs, I'll go first, because he is what's called an agency worker. He's come in from Eastern Europe, and my job is vulnerable now because he's working for less. And actually, what we should have done is we should have legislated to stop undermining of wages. So that is like a genuine fear. That was that guy's living standards affected. That wasn't prejudice or an illusory, you know, myth that he'd been preyed to. So I think, though, that, you know, there are many more people actually helping people who are ill in the NHS than are in hospital beds. There are many more immigrants who are helping in the health service than using the health service. And there are many more people who are actually picking the crops than eating the immigrants that are picking the crops than are actually eating the food. And I think that there is, we've tended to, I think, in the Labour Party, be a bit averse to talking about immigration because we've been worried about whether or not it would be like getting involved in racism, racist discussions. So we've kind of shrunk away. Let's talk about the NHS. Let's talk about jobs. Let's talk about housing. Let's talk about things which we feel much more straightforward about. And the trouble is, if you don't talk about it, you leave it to people who don't take the same view as we do and are, you know, are prejudiced, and then you get a more twisted situation. So I think you've got to address people's real concerns, but also challenge the myths.
It's, again, because of the internet, I think it's a problem at the moment. I think it needs to be talked about a lot by politicians, because I think it's a subject that needs to...
And also, if people think that you won't let them talk about it because you suspect their motives, and therefore nobody's allowed to talk about it because if they talk about it, they're all condemned as racist, that is terrible.
Yeah, on this subject, you've got far left, far right. We need some chat in the middle of it, I imagine. I'm conscious of time. There's a couple of other things I want to discuss. So your book got me thinking so much, and I thank you for that. It's awoken some stuff in me. Another issue on equality that you're really keen on is the sort of birth lottery. The fact that people are born into a better life than others, and you want a quality in that, which is hard to achieve, as we all know. But it got me thinking about this country, and it got me thinking about our sort of class system, which supposedly doesn't exist anymore, but actually probably does. How influential is it still in our society, especially in politics?
I think it's massively influential, and I think that it's the opposite of a meritocracy, because actually a country does better and an economy does better if everybody's able to achieve their full potential. So it's not just about individuals' rights, but it's actually about making things work better. If you think about those countries that are going nowhere, are real stultified, it's the ones which are really hierarchical, which is the family that you're born into matters, not what you can contribute. So I think that tackling inequality, which is based on class, is really fundamentally important.
What do you think of our education system? We've got, I mean, I've laid my cards on the table. My kids have been to state schools, private schools, grammar schools, the lot. Private schools is absolutely phenomenal, the standard of education. I can't say how amazing it is. However, I don't believe in private schools or faith schools. I think they're a really bad thing for our society, separating children through finance or religion. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the overwhelming majority of young people go to schools which are, you know, co-educational, boys and girls, ordinary comprehensive schools, and the most important thing is to improve the level of all of those, and I think that they have improved over the years. But I think that that it's right for us to be questioning that private schools have charitable status, which means they get all sorts of tax breaks and such like, and whether they really are charities, because they're called charities because they're committed to giving a service of education. And that was one of the old fundamental objects of charities, relief of poverty, health, education. So it's a bit of an anomaly there. So I think actually saying, well, are you really charitable?
Yeah.
Well, you're not really charitable.
But I think the private education that I witnessed was phenomenal, and I think all our schools should be like that. And I think, I mean, I'm maybe an idealist, but if you got rid of the private schools, all the parents who would send their kids to private schools would soon invest time and effort into the local schools to get them up to that level.
But it's also a question of the investment that goes into schools.
Yeah.
Because actually, if you've got fantastic school buildings, fantastic arts and music facilities, fantastic sports facilities, and you've got well-paid teachers and you've got small classes, actually money, and you've got money is really important investment into schools. And the big difference between state schools and private schools is the money per pupil.
But
it's just different.
I've sort of gone away from my point here, actually, is that are these big schools still are they still providing the talent in politics? Harrow's, Eton's and stuff like that. Is it still feeding into that? They're obviously feeding still our legal companies and
I think not so much so. I think there is a big division, though, in the percentage of people who are in the House of Commons who had higher education, who went to university, compared to the people in the country. Most people in the country didn't go to university. Most people in the House of Commons did go to university. So that is the kind of educational divide. Okay. I think it will catch up, because I think more people in the country are going to university now. I mean, in my constituency, the number of young people going to university has trebled, which is really important. But so I think there's a bit of a time lag there.
What do you think of the royal family?
Oh, do you know, it's like, that's my one sort of like no-go area. It's like I've had rows about every single under the bloody sun.
Is that but question that you think,
like,
I don't want to answer?
It's like,
that one.
I am not going to get into an argument about the royal family, because I'm so busy having so many other arguments that I'm just not going to get into that one, albeit I am the world's expert on Meghan Markle and the royal family, but I'm not going to say anything.
Because your book made me think, I won't keep pushing you, I'm not going to do this, but your book made me think, because you were talking about setting examples and things, I'm wondering if it sends the right message through. I've never been anti-royal at all. But I was thinking, is it sending the right message? If you want people to be upwardly mobile, you've got to obviously get some people to be downwardly
mobile. Well, she's certainly upwardly mobile by marriage, which is not exactly what the women's movement was aspiring to. However, I'm sure she can do some good.
But, yeah.
Sounds a bit crushing, doesn't it?
I watched the Crown, and the one thing I couldn't... You know, that's my history of the royal family, basically, is the Crown. I'll be honest with you. But the one thing which really shocked me was the Prime Minister turning up there every Tuesday to talk to her. I'm thinking... But I live in a democracy. And it was the one thing that I found really shocking, that Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or whoever, Margaret Thatcher, would have to go and sit with the Queen.
They still do that.
What's it got to do with her? I mean, I don't hate the Queen, but what has it got to do with somebody who's not been democratic? And I understood sort of through the war. But now we're all the way down, you know, 2018. Why are we it just seems bizarre. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's really surreal.
Well, it's just... how it is.
If I was Paxman, you know, I'd be at you now. I'd be like, come on, royal family,
I know,
you get in
but,
there.
But I've got the tranquility now of just knowing that there are some questions I'm not going to answer, because I am having enough rows to, you know, fill a whole Albert Hall.
My last question to you is going to be, would you curtsy to the Queen? That's my last one. I'm just warning you, I'm going to do that now. You don't?
No, I don't. But you see, I think I'm quite hung up on symbols. I don't wear a wedding ring.
Yeah,
because
I know.
In the olden days, the olden days, the woman put the ring on to show she was taken.
Yeah.
And that she had the status of a married woman, and that meant everything. The man never wore a ring. You know, I didn't have a white wedding dress. I think all these symbols I'm quite hung up on, because I fought against what they mean.
Yeah.
And the idea... to curtsy to somebody because of what family they were born into. I know it would be polite to do it because everybody else does it, but I'm afraid I can't. But anyway, you know, the Queen doesn't seem to have taken umbrage to it. You know, she's probably
because that's the Jeremy Corbyn got caught on that, didn't he? Because you can tell he doesn't want to bow. Or no, he said he had to go on a knee or something.
I can't remember. There was so much mythology about Jeremy Corbyn and the Queen. It's just like, who knows what?
But I think sometimes the media makes such a thing about it and the public are sitting there going, do we really care about this sort of stuff, you know? But I don't know. Maybe we do. You're going to PMQs in a minute, aren't you? So let's quickly get on to this. Politics is a power battle, isn't it?
It is a battle because it's a contest between different ideas and different arguments about how things should be run. You know, it's not a career to roll into the House of Commons and do a day job. It is a quest for what direction the country should take. So it is a very passionate and heartfelt thing.
Okay. If I could be slightly critical, I read Tony Blair's, but it was so long ago, I can't remember it all. But I do remember bits of it where he said he got into power and he thought, yeah, New Labour, here I am. I've got all my MPs with me. And then realised that not only was he fighting against the opposition, he was having to infights in his own party. It was just a huge power struggle. It sort of gets away from the point of politics, which is you're supposed to be there to help the public and work together. And if the Labour Party can't even work together, I know the Tories can't either, then it's quite hard for you to achieve.
Well, except that we've got to strike that balance, haven't we? We've got to, like, support our leader and be coherent and present a face to the public which they can see what we stand for because we're clear. But on the other hand, you don't want to have a dictatorship of a leader. So if somebody's got a new idea, the leader says, well, sorry, that's not my idea, you can shut up. So it's about creating that balance of there being scope for different opinions, but also some sort of coherence. Because, I mean, you were right in the 80s. I would knock on a door asking people to vote Labour and they'd say, I don't even know what you stand for anymore. Each time I turn the telly on, people saying something completely different. They're all arguing amongst themselves. So you can't have too many arguments, but you don't want to have dictatorship of the leadership. And it's getting that balance, which is difficult.
But how hard is it? How hard is it to be part of a party who you've got to toe the line a bit? I mean, I used to be friends with an MP who really didn't want to go to war, didn't think the one of your Labour comrades, but he had to vote on it in the end because
he didn't. He could have voted against it, and lots of them did. I voted for it because I believe there was a real danger. There was weapons of mass destruction there, and Saddam Hussein had already been, you know, gassing the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs and everything. So I made my own choice. I don't hold with MPs ever blaming anybody else.
Right.
Because when you're in that House of Commons, you have got the responsibility for how you'll vote. And you can't blame anybody else.
But people hold grudges against you. John Prescott holds a grudge against you in your book. He doesn't like you.
Well, lots of people hold grudges against everybody, but
so you've got
still have got to make your own choice about how you vote and not blame anybody else.
All right, but that's you, and I've read your book, and that's how you've gone through your career. But a lot of MPs will think, toe the line here, I get a chance to get in the cabinet.
Well, you know, I think that that's pointless because...
Yeah, but it happens, you know, it must
Yeah. do. Well, I think it's pointless and wrong and it doesn't serve them well. What really matters is what you believe in and listening to other people, but pushing forward for what you believe in. And so if you ever do something that you don't agree with because it's for your own career advantage, it jumps up and bites you on the backside anyway.
So what's going on with this mess with Brexit then at the moment? Because none of the parties can agree on anything. And you even internally in your own parties and against each other, it's just...
Well, I think it's really, really, really difficult. I think that I wish we'd have never had a referendum, and I wish once we'd got a referendum that we hadn't voted to leave, because I really fear for what is going to happen to our economy, but also to our constitution. I mean, it's like given turbocharging to the independence movement in Scotland because they voted to remain. It's created all sorts of problems about the Northern Ireland peace agreement. I don't know who's going to buy our goods. I mean... Trump is busy saying that they're going to put America first and not buy anything of ours. If we're not able to sell into the EU because we've left, I really worry about our economy. I mean, you know, I think that it's quite difficult also for the Prime Minister to negotiate because within her own party, she has not got agreement. So I think... Actually, having been in the House of Commons and been in politics for more than 35 years, I've never felt there to be a more perilous and difficult situation for the country. And I can't actually see from where we are now the country having voted to leave. I can't see how we're going to get a good solution. I mean, I'm hoping and praying for the sake of the country. Well, I'm not praying because I'm not religious. I'm hoping that for the sake of the country, we will get a good solution. But I can't see the path. Normally, I've been able to see the path and you fight for it. I just can't see the path at the moment.
I actually think you've kind of let us all down as politicians because you've given us an impossible situation by the referendum. It's, we haven't let us down. But
that was David Cameron's fault, not David politicians. It's like he put it in the manifesto because he was worried about the arguments with his backbenchers, and he thought if he would give them a referendum in the manifesto, they'd all shut up and leave him alone.
It's a power game. It's people trying to keep hold of their jobs.
I think he should have put the energy into arguing against them instead of trying to chillax and just put something in the manifesto, hoping that it would never happen, and if it did happen, that he would win it.
Mm.
I think that is going to be looked back in history as, you know, it's never worth doing something to get an easy life as a politician, because it can have catastrophic consequences, especially as a prime minister.
Yeah. What do you think of Theresa May? Is she feminist?
Well, I think that basically she never was. She was more in the Margaret Thatcher role of a woman than in the modern feminist role.
Okay, what do you think of Margaret Thatcher?
We're the Labour Party. We believe in redemption. So I think there is still a chance for Theresa May. And after all, I mean, she's having such an absolute dire time over Brexit, and she herself voted to remain, and she's now presiding over a government that's having to leave. But she is still powerful. She's still the Prime Minister. She has got a massive opportunity. She could say, right, aside from the Brexit stuff, which is all going to hell in a handcart, I'm going to do amazing things that are going to help women be equal. And if she does that, I shall be backing her all the way. But, you know, it's too early to say.
Do you know, one of my favourite bits of your book is when you sort of start going, you're an MP and you have to suddenly decide what you're going to wear. I thought that's a really interesting bit because women, you know, there weren't any women around, were there, in these positions, MPs and stuff. And so you've got to decide, are you going to dress like Margaret Thatcher? Because she was...
Well, I think that, you know, people regard it as very trivial to discuss clothes and what you wear, but being in the House of Commons as a young woman, I didn't know what to wear.
No.
And I started off in a red velvet maternity dress, looking completely out of place. And I was out of place. And then there came this argument about... And then I was drifting around in a sort of Laura Ashley floral frock and looking like I wasn't an MP. And I wanted my constituents to feel confident in me and to know that they could come to me with their problems and I'd speak up for them. And they'd turn up and there would be this person with their floral dress looking like Lady Di. And so the idea that we should have briefcases instead of handbags and that we should have a suit with shoulder pads on instead of floaty dresses, it made us feel a bit more professional. So it was important because we were trying to be women in what had previously been a man's world. And I was never going to be like one of the tweedy matrons of the Conservative Party because I was a young woman.
Hmm.
But anyway, there we are.
And you were spent most of your career pregnant, as the book says. So you spent a lot of it pregnant. Talking about Prime Minister Question Times, I've been there. I came along and watched it once. I don't want to be too rude, but it's ridiculous. And I find the whole thing, I found it really painful to watch because you've got very intelligent people not having a discussion. You're talking to each other. I mean, the way people were speaking to each other was horrific, I thought. And then you expect the public to respect the politicians. I think it's a really hard sell, that, and I know it's an old boys thing from years ago where you all crack jokes at each other and all that sort of stuff, and now but I always thought when you know, people like yourself were involved in it, and Theresa May and actually Jeremy Corbyn when he started speaking, I suddenly thought, oh, they might change now and show each other a bit of respect, but they don't. You're just telling jokes at each other all the time.
Well, I agree with you that it is completely bizarre and mad, but it's quite hard to change because, like, Tony Blair said he was going to change it, David Cameron said he was going to change it, but it seems to have got completely stuck where you've got two tribes and you've got to show that your tribe behind you is shouting more at the other side than they're shouting at you. And it is, It is a very bizarre ritual. If you found it painful to watch, it's even more painful to be doing it.
Do you know what?
Trust me.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I found the whole thing quite pathetic because, you know, when Theresa May starts doing jokes, you're like, oh, come on.
The thing is that what we need to do is
stand-up.
We do need a situation where the Prime Minister and other government ministers actually answer for what they're doing. We do need an opportunity for where MPs can say to the Prime Minister, this is what's happening in my constituency, what are you going to do to sort it out? So the function of it is necessary.
Yes.
The form which it takes is absolutely not right. But the question is, what is the form that it should take?
A conversation.
And how... But you see,
with respect.
But
Dennis Skinner gets up all the time and does he's insulting the opposition. And everyone goes, oh, he's an old pro, he's brilliant. It's like, no, it's like a...
But you see, in Scotland now, they've got a different thing in the Holyrood Parliament. And they've got it slightly differently in Wales. So it might be that we can migrate to that. But when you look at the American system, for example, they're all fast asleep. It's all kind of snoozy.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you want it to have a little bit of edge, but you don't want it to descend into farce. So it's a question, but
I think that is
important because what you can't do is let ministers off the hook. You've got to hold their feet to the flame, but you've got to do it in a way which makes sense. And we haven't quite got there yet. Perhaps another 600 years of working on it.
It's when they put the TV in, suddenly you started watching it and you were like, oh, God, really? Are they
really
doing
it? It was worse before they had the TV.
But you watch that, right, exactly. But you watch their faces as they go, you know, and it's like, God, Jesus, you're paid to work for us. Have a conversation with these people. But you're right. You need probably a bit of energy in there. All right. As I say, I'm conscious of you having to leave. So I've got my questions to ask everybody. So can I ask these to you as well? What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that's been invaluable to your life?
Don't worry if you're having a row. If you are not having a row, you're probably not doing enough.
Okay, what mistake do people make? Maybe doing your job, maybe an MP.
I think being too reasonable. I think that when you want change, you should assemble all your unreasonable demands because today's unreasonable demands are tomorrow's conventional wisdom. Mm.
Talking about tomorrow, do you sit and contemplate 10 years' time, 15 years' time when you're sitting in the Labour Party, or do you keep it pretty much within the next few years?
Well, I've got a job to do now from when I was elected in 2017, which is to represent my constituents. And that is my job right in here and now. And it's like a 5-year term. You make a 5-year pledge. So that's what I'm on.
We've got global issues at the moment. Is there any way that we could have cross-party organisations looking after things like the NHS or maybe climate change? Or could that ever happen?
I think there is quite a lot of cross-party working. I think in a way, people don't like it if all the parties are the same and they say, why should we vote? You're all the same. There's no choice. So they want a difference. But where we don't disagree, they want us to work together. And I think it's important always to look for those...
Do we disagree on the NHS?
I think we disagree on the amount of money that ought to go into the NHS. Yeah. We think a lot more is needed. And I mean, like in King's College Hospital at the moment, it's been put on special measures. Actually, it used to be an excellent hospital. It just hasn't got enough money. I mean, it's not that they're all lolling about or you know, not doing their job.
Are we looking at, though, are all, do you ever get together with the other side and go, look, climate change is a huge issue. We need to work together on this or global taxation or global migration. We need to start looking at this as a global...
I think there's a lot of that goes on climate change. Yes, there is. On global taxation, there is. Margaret Hodge, who used to do the Public Accounts Committee, she's now got a cross-party group on stopping tax avoidance. So there are these cross-party groups, and I think there's now a lot more opportunity to work cross-party amongst the women because there's women on the Tory side now as well as the Labour side. So actually, if we got together and there's 200 of us, we could really start dictating the terms now.
That's good. By the way, I always think with prime ministers, so you tell your Jeremy Corbyn or whoever's the next one come along, I always think when they stand there and go, I will do this, I will reduce tax, I reckon if they change the word to we, it'd be a lot better because you'd think, oh, he's got a team behind them, or she's got a team behind
them. I totally agree,
really,
but they feel the necessity to show that they are leaderish and powerful. And I think the strongest is to show the that team. You're the leader of a team.
Yeah.
No, I don't like the I word.
I'd
and
love
also,
it.
It's not the reality. Yeah. The truth is, you can't do
exactly.
anything on your own.
Exactly.
You have to work
I'm
together.
Gonna be on Primary Questions Time today, she'll go I. And it's not I. We know it's not. Right. Any life hacks?
Is this the one where I tell you about my potato ricer?
Yes, it is. That is exactly right. Yeah.
It's funny because it's not about rice, just in case anybody doesn't realise. It's about the perfect mashed potato every time.
That is it.
I had to wait till I was in my 60s to know about that.
Yeah, and you're supposed to put a third of mashed potato is supposed to be butter, according to chefs.
That's marvellous, isn't it?
It's tasty. What's it like being famous?
But English people are quite odd, actually, really. British people is because I sometimes notice people giving me a glance, but people don't, by and large, if you're just going about your daily business, they don't come up and sort of chat to you. In my constituency, they do.
I want to talk to you about the bins.
Yeah, they do. And that's their perfect right. That's part of the job. But a lot of the time, I don't really notice it anymore. Mm. But I do notice other famous people when I do rubber neck at them.
Yeah. I know my MPs around here.
But I'm not Ed Sheeran when all's said and done. I mean, I'm like, you know, let's get this in proportion.
All right. What's the meaning of life?
I think it's best really not to think about the meaning of life, but just to get on with it. Because if you're constantly thinking about what the meaning of life is, I think you just tie yourself up in knots.
Hmm. Have you enjoyed your political career?
I think it's been incredibly rewarding, demanding, energising, knackering. I think I can enjoy it with hindsight, but I'm not sure that's the word I would use at the time. But it's been, you know, people say it's been a privilege. It has been a privilege. It's been an absolute privilege to be elected by people and to represent them. I mean, that is the business.
Have you made a difference?
I think I have.
I think you have. I read your book and I said it earlier, you're relentless. It's been absolutely...
But it has been the team, the women's movement, the whole women's movement.
Yeah.
It's not, nobody would do that on their own. It was like a whole movement.
Alistair Campbell said something to me recently, it was on my show Sunday Brunch, and he said that you don't hold a grudge, which he said is good because I think you might have fallen out with him in the past or you've had a few little disagreements with him.
Well, I think it's... I don't not hold grudges by any... virtue, but because I forget, I've had so many arguments with so many people over the years, I can vaguely remember and think, God, aren't I having an argument with you? But I can't remember what it was about. And also, I think of our wonderful Jo Cox, you know, that MP who was murdered, who said in her first speech that she made in the House of Commons, that we've got more in common than what divides us.
Yeah.
And as a party politician, that was a very brave thing to say and very true. And actually, if you spend your time thinking about grudges, you don't think about what unites us. I mean, she was a wonderful woman, such a loss. But all we can do really is just think about what she said and try and live as good as that.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much. Have you got any questions in Prime Minister's time, question time tonight?
No, I should be one of those people baying and cheering looking absolutely bonkers.
Thank you so much. A Woman's Work is out now. Thank you, Harriet. I enjoyed that. Do you think Harriet enjoyed that, Mark?
It was hard to tell. I think so, yes.
She must get interviewed by so many people.
Yeah, and you have to have... Well, she must always be... Well, she must be, and politicians must be expecting some left-field question that's going to undermine what they've just said.
Her book is called A Woman's Work. Do you know what? I really recommend it. Really well worth the read. And I think especially in this climate, it's important to remember where we were, where we've got to, and hopefully where we're going. I think it's... said on the podcast, hopefully it's the final push.
I've got a question to ask you, Tim.
Go on.
Should we get rid of the royal family?
Mark, there's some questions...
Don't start.
There's some questions I can't answer. There's some questions I just will not answer.
The country wants to know, when you are Prime Minister, Tim, will you get rid of the royal family?
How amazingly awkward is that question? Because I've never thought about it until I read her book. and watch The Crown. The two things
that was so good
that coincided. That is my history of the whole family.
It was really funny because I'll be watching The Crown, right? And her
Claire.
Yes. They just both started laughing.
Yeah, it's true though. It's like I don't dislike the royal family at all, but I have no particular interest in learning them. And so, after watching The Crown, I sort of got into it. And that is kind of my history. It's basically like a dramatisation.
Basing all your royal knowledge on King Ralph, the John Goodman film when he became king because everyone in the royal family had died.
Fascinating, though, because the one thing I got from it, though, The Crown, is the idea that the Prime Minister's going to see the Queen all the time and she has
influence. I just reckon you could have come into it in a different way, okay? Because I've seen The Crown, right?
Matt, I'm the man of the people and I'm thinking the rest of the country are all sitting there going, hold on, does the Prime Minister really go in every Tuesday? See, I honestly thought until I watched The Crown is that the Prime Minister would go in once a year or something.
You must have known that was a thing.
I knew they had to go and see the Queen, but I thought it would be so irregular, once a year, maybe once every 6 months or something. And I thought it would probably be a cup of tea and a traditional type thing, turn around three times, put a hat on or something, all those sort of bizarre traditions we have over here. But I had no idea about that.
But it's put
the thought process in my mind as to, hold on, let's question, I've always taught early, question absolutely everything. Why does something happen? Why is it happening? So that's food for thought, but I haven't made my mind up yet. And you're not pushing me on it, Mark. You're not getting an answer out of me today. But there you go. All right, what's your thoughts on the royal family?
I don't know.
Let's discuss it off air. If you've got any thoughts on anything to do with this podcast, please...
Crown related, anything.
Yeah, if you... Oh, something's ringing.
Who's that? Is that your phone? You're ringing someone.
Oh, I'm ringing in my pocket. This podcast is ridiculous. We have postmans. We have postmans.
Postperson.
First person. I have a first person. I have cats meowing at us. We have people that I don't know. Couriers knocking at the door. Phones ringing.
People coming to fix lights that have been broken.
Coffee machines. Anyway, we've been rattling on for far too long. Now, look, if you want to contact Twitter @TimLovejoy. Email dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. You can subscribe to us. You can rate us 5 stars. That's it. We'll be back very soon with another podcast for the time being. Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at freestylelibre.us.